dear Henry, with too much severity," Francis wrote. "Never in those times when I have wept the most bitterly over the decay of my young dreams have I thought you otherwise than good and kind. When I realized most forcibly that love is the whole history of woman and but an episode in the life of man, even then I imputed it not to you as a fault, but reproached myself for wishing to exact a return for affections which I felt were too intense." She assured him that the love of another could never bring her consolation. God had kept her in the right path. By return mail, Seward pledged that he desired nothing but to return home, to share the family duties, and read by the fireside on the long winter nights, to live for you and for our dear boys, to be a partner in your thoughts and cares and feelings. With Francis to support him, Seward promised to renew his Episcopal faith and attempt to find his way to God. He was counting with eagerness, he concluded, the hours which intervene between this period and the time when that life will commence. As Seward took leave of the many friends he had made in his 4 years in Albany, he decided against confronting Tracy. The day before his scheduled departure, however, a curious letter from his old friend provoked an immediate response. The letter opened with halcyon recollections of the early days of their acquaintance, when Tracy still possessed golden dreams of a devoted, peculiar friendship. "How much I suffered," he wrote, "when I was first awakened to the perception that these were only dreams. For this you are no way responsible. You loved me as much as you could, but it was less, far less, than I hoped." He explained that this pain, this disappointment, is my excuse for the capriciousness and too frequent unkindness which I have displayed towards you. In an emotional reply, Seward explained that Tracy misunderstood completely the nature of the alienation that had befallen them. "Availing yourself of the relation existing between us," Seward charged, "you did, with or without premeditated purpose, what, as a man of honor, you ought not to have done. Pursued a course of conduct which, but for the virtue and firmness of the being dearest to me, would have destroyed his entire family." Seward related his initial reluctance to read the letters Francis had surrendered to him, and his conclusion, after reading them, that Tracy had failed to do me the injury you recklessly contemplated. "Thenceforth, Tracy," he wrote, "you lost that magic influence you once possessed over me. You still have my respect as a man of eminent talents and of much virtue, but you can never again be the friend of my secret thoughts. I part without anger, but without affection." Even at this heavy moment, Seward remained the consummate politician, unwilling to burn his bridges completely. If Seward believed the crisis with Francis had forever muted the voice of his public ambitions with a contented domesticity, he was mistaken. No sooner had he returned to Auburn than he admitted to a friend, "It is seldom that persons who enjoy intervals of public life are happy in their periods of seclusion." Within days, he was writing to Weed, pleading with his old friend and mentor to "keep me informed upon political matters, and take care that I do not so far get absorbed in professional occupation that you will cease to care for me as a politician." In the summer of 1835, seeking distraction from the tedium of his legal practice, the 34-year-old Seward organized a family expedition to the South. He and Francis occupied the back seat of a horse-drawn carriage, while their 5-year-old son, Fred, sat up front with the coachman, former slave William Johnson. Their elder son, Gus, remained at home with his grandfather. Seward, as always, was thrilled by the journey. "When I travel," he explained, "I banish care and thought and reflection. Over a 3-month period, the little party traveled through Pennsylvania and Virginia, stopping at the nation's capital on their way back. While their letters home extolled the warmth and generous hospitality extended to them by Southerners all along their route, their first-hand encounter with the consequences of slavery profoundly affected their attitudes toward the South. At the time of their journey, 3 decades of immigration, commercial enterprise, and industrial production had invigorated Northern society, creating thriving cities and towns. The historian Kenneth Stamp well describes how the North of this period teemed with bustling, restless men and women who believed passionately in progress and equated it with growth and change. The air was filled with the excitement of intellectual ferment and with the schemes of entrepreneurs. And the land was honeycombed with societies aiming at nothing less than the total reform of mankind. Yet, crossing into Virginia, the Sewards entered a world virtually unchanged since 1800. "We no longer passed frequent farmhouses, taverns, and shops," Henry wrote as the family carriage wound its way through Virginia's Allegheny Mountains, "but our rough road conducted us past low log huts, the habitations of slaves." They rarely encountered other travelers, finding instead a waste, broken tract of land with here and there an old, decaying habitation. Seward lamented, "How deeply the curse of slavery is set upon this venerated and storied region of the Old Dominion. Of all the countries I have seen, France only, whose energies have for 40 years been expended in war, and whose population has been more decimated by the sword, is as much decayed as Virginia." The poverty, neglect, and stagnation Seward surveyed seemed to pervade both the landscape and its inhabitants. Slavery trapped a large portion of the southern population, preventing upward mobility. Illiteracy rates were high, access to education difficult. While a small planter aristocracy grew rich from holdings in land and slaves, the static southern economy did not support the creation of a sizable middle class. While Seward focused on the economic and political depredations of slavery, Frances responded to the human plight of the enslaved men, women, and children she encountered along the journey. "We are told that we see slavery here in its mildest form," she wrote her sister, "but disguise thyself as thou wilt, still, slavery, thou art a bitter draught." She could not stop thinking of the wrongs of this injured race. One day, Frances stopped the carriage to converse with an old blind slave woman who was at work turning the ponderous wheel of a machine in a yard. The work was hard, but she had to do something, she explained, "and this is all I can do now I am so old." When Frances asked about her family, she revealed that her husband and all her children had been sold long ago to different owners, and she had never heard from any of them again. This sad encounter left a lasting impression on Frances. She recorded the interview in detail, and later read it out loud to family and friends in Auburn. A few days afterward, the Sewards came across a group of slave children chained together on the road outside of Richmond. Henry described the sorrowful scene. 10 naked little boys, between 6 and 12 years old, tied together, 2 and 2, by their wrists, were all fastened to a long rope, and followed by a tall, gaunt white man, who, with his long lash, whipped up the sad and weary little procession, drove it to the horse trough to drink, and thence to a shed, where they lay down on the ground and sobbed and moaned themselves to sleep. The children had been purchased from different plantations that day, and were on their way to be auctioned off at Richmond. Frances could not endure to continue the journey. "Sick of slavery and the South," she wrote in her diary, "the evil effects constantly coming before me and marring everything." She begged her husband to cancel the rest of their tour, and he complied. Instead of continuing south to Richmond, they turned their horses' heads northward and homeward. For decades afterward, indelible images of Southern poverty and the misery of enslaved blacks would strengthen Seward's hostility to slavery and mold Francis's powerful social conscience. When Seward returned to Auburn, a lucrative opportunity beckoned. The Holland Land Company, which held more than 300,000 acres of undeveloped land in western New York, was searching for a manager to parcel the land and negotiate contracts and deeds with prospective settlers. The company offered Seward a multi-year contract with an annual salary of $5,000 plus a share in the profits. Though accepting the position meant he would reside for months at a time in Chautauqua County, more than 100 miles from his family and home in Auburn, Seward did not hesitate. He took a leave from his law firm and rented a 5-bedroom house in Westfield, more beautiful than you can have an idea, hopeful that his wife and family would join him during the summer months. In the meantime, he invited Weed's 17-year-old daughter, Harriet, to keep Francis company in Auburn and to help with the two boys and their new baby girl, Cornelia, born in August 1836. Seward soon found the land-developing business more engaging than law. The 6 young clerks he hired quickly became a surrogate domestic circle, though he assured Francis in his nightly letters that he missed her and his children terribly. Once more he reiterated how he yearned for the day when they would read aloud to each other by the fire. He had just finished and enjoyed 3 of Scott's Waverley novels, but there are 1,000 things in them, as in Shakespeare, that one may enjoy more and much longer if one has somebody to converse with while dwelling upon them. His children pined for him and the vibrant life his presence brought to the household. More than a half century later, his son Fred so vividly remembered one particular evening when his father read aloud from the works of Scott and Burns that he realized it must have been a rare event. Life in Westfield, meanwhile, settled into a pleasant routine. So long as Seward kept intact the image of his happy home in Auburn, he could fully immerse himself in new adventure elsewhere. His serenity was shattered when his little girl contracted smallpox and died in January 1837. Returning home for 3 weeks, he begged Frances, who had plunged into depression, to come back with him to Westfield. She refused to leave her 2 boys and did not think it would be quite right to take them both from their grandpa. Back in Westfield, Seward wrote anxiously to Francis that the lightness that was in all my heart when I thought of you and your sanctuary and those who surrounded you there was the main constituent of my cheerfulness. But now I imagine you sitting alone, drooping, desponding, and unhappy. And when I think of you in this condition, I cannot resist the sorrow that swells within me. If I could be with you, to lure you away to more active pursuits, to varied study, or more cheerful thoughts, I might save you for yourself, for your children, for myself. The following summer, Francis was finally persuaded to join him in Westfield. In an exultant letter to Weed, Seward expressed his contentment. "Well, I am here for once enjoying the reality of dreams," he wrote. "I read much, I ride some, and stroll more along the lake shore. My wife and children are enjoying a measure of health which enables them to participate in these pleasures." He lacked but one thing to complete his happiness. "If you were here," he told Weed, "we would enjoy pleasures that would have seduced Cicero and his philosophic friends from Tusculum." While Frances enjoyed her summer, she was unable to share her husband's great contentment. Returning to Auburn in September, she told Harriet Weed she had found Westfield a very pleasant little village, but it was not my home, and you can very well understand that I am more happy to be here. There is a sort of satisfaction, melancholy it is, in being once more in the room where my darling babe lived and died, in looking over her little wardrobe, in talking with those who missed and loved her. By the fall of 1837, an economic slump had spread westward to Chautauqua County. This panic of 1837 brought widespread misery in its wake. Bankrupt businesses, high unemployment, a run on banks, plummeting real estate values, escalating poverty. "I am almost in despair," Seward wrote home. "I have to dismiss 3 clerks. They all seem near to me as children and are almost as helpless." Once again, fortune smiled upon Seward in uncanny fashion. Because Democrats were blamed for the Depression, the shrinking economy enlarged his party's political prospects. In the elections that fall, the Whigs swept the state. "There is such a buzz of glorious Whig victories ringing in my ears," Seward wrote Weed, "that I hardly have time to think." Replying from Albany, where he was back in control, Weed was jubilant. "I have been 2 days endeavoring to snatch a moment for communion with you, to whom my heart always turns in joy or grief. It is a great triumph, an overwhelming revolution. May that providence which has given us deliverance give us also wisdom to turn our power into healthful channels." In the months that followed, Seward and Weed worked together to broaden the Whig Party beyond its base of merchants, industrialists, and prosperous farmers, hoping to appeal to the masses of working men who had generally voted Democratic since Andrew Jackson's day. Weed raised money for a new partisan weekly. Horace Greeley was chosen editor for the fledgling journal. The slight, rumpled-looking, nearsighted young Greeley occupied a garret in New York where he had edited a small magazine called The New Yorker. The new partisan weekly became an instant success, eventually evolving into the powerful New York Tribune. For nearly a quarter of a century, Weed, Seward, and Greeley collaborated to build support, first for the Whigs, and later on for the Republicans. For much of that time, the three were like brothers. If they often quarreled among themselves, they presented a united front to the world. In the summer of 1838, Weed believed the time was right for Seward's second bid to become governor. At the Whig convention that September, the dictator was everywhere, persuading one delegate after another that Seward was the strongest possible choice to top the ticket. To bolster his case, he distributed statistics from the 1834 gubernatorial race showing that despite the Whigs' loss, Seward had claimed more votes than all the other Whig candidates. Weed's magic worked. His protege received the nomination on the 4th ballot. "Well, Seward, we are again embarked upon a sea of difficulties and must go earnestly to work." In fact, most of the work was left to Weed, since it was thought improper in those days for candidates to stump on their own. And Weed did his job well. When the votes were counted, the 37-year-old Seward was the overwhelming victor. Seward was thrilled to be back in the thick of things. "God bless Thurlow Weed," he exulted. "I owe this result to him." Within a week of the election, however, Seward's nerve began to fail. "It is a fearful post I have coveted," he confided to his mentor. "I shudder at my own temerity, and have lost confidence in my ability to manage my own private affairs." Frances, pregnant with their third son, Will, had suffered weeks of illness and was nervous about the move to Albany. Confessing that he did not know how to keep a house alone, he wondered if he could instead take up rooms at the Eagle Tavern. Weed arrived in Auburn and immediately took charge. He secured a mansion with a full-time staff for the governor to rent, and convinced Frances to join her husband. The yellow brick house, Seward's son Fred recalled, was in all respects well adapted for an official residence. Set on 4 acres, it contained a suite of parlors, a ballroom, a spacious dining room, and a library in one wing, with a suite of family rooms in another. While Seward combed through books on history and philosophy, preparing what proved to be a brilliant inaugural message to the legislature, Weed stocked the residents with wine and food, chose Seward's inaugural outfit, and met with hundreds of office seekers, eventually selecting every member of the governor's cabinet. Seward believed it was his duty to receive, not make, a cabinet. During the transition period, Seward's impulsive remarks often aggravated the ever-cautious Weed. "Your letter admonishes me to a habit of caution that I cannot conveniently adopt," Seward replied. "I love to write what I think and feel as it comes up." Nonetheless, Seward generally deferred to Weed, recognizing a superior strategic prudence and experience. "I had no idea that dictators were such amiable creatures," he told Weed, no doubt provoking the approval of his proud mentor. "There were never two men in politics who worked together or understood each other better," Weed wrote years later in his memoir. "Neither controlled the other. One did not always lead and the other follow. They were friends, in the best, the rarest, and highest sense." In later years, Seward told the story of a carriage ride he took from Albany shortly after his election. He had struck up a lively conversation with the coachman, who eventually asked him who he was. When Seward replied that he was governor of New York, the coachman laughed in disbelief. Seward said they had only to consult the proprietor of the next tavern along the road to confirm the truth. When they reached the tavern, Seward went in and asked, "Am I the governor of the state of New York or not?" The man did not hesitate. "No, certainly not." "Who is then?" queried Seward. "Why, Thurlow Weed," the man replied. The youthful governor's inaugural address on New Year's Day, 1839, laid out an ambitious agenda. A vast expansion of the public school system, including better schools for the black population, the promotion of canals and railways, the creation of a more humane system for the treatment of the insane, and the abolition of imprisonment for debt. His vision of an ever-expanding economy, built on free labor, widespread public education, and technological progress, offered a categorical rejection of the economic and cultural malaise he had witnessed on his southern trip in 1835. "Our race is ordained to reach, on this continent, a higher standard of social perfection than it has ever yet attained, and that hence will proceed the spirit which shall renovate the world," he proclaimed to the New York legislature in the year of his election. If the energy, ingenuity, and ambitions of Northern free labor were "sustained by a wise and magnanimous policy on our part," Seward promised, "our state, within 20 years, will have no desert places. Her commercial ascendancy will fear no rivalry, and 100 cities will enable her to renew the boast of ancient Crete." Looking once more to broaden the appeal of the Whig Party, Seward advocated measures to attract the Irish and German Catholic immigrants who formed the backbone of the state Democratic Party. He called on his fellow Americans to welcome them with all the sympathy which their misfortunes at home, their condition as strangers here, and their devotion to liberty ought to excite. He argued that America owed all the benefits of citizenship to these new arrivals, who helped power the engine of Northern expansion. In particular, he proposed to reform the school system, where the virulently anti-Catholic curriculum frightened immigrants away, dooming vast numbers to illiteracy, poverty, and vice. To get these children off the streets and provide them with opportunities to advance, Seward hoped to divert some part of the public school funds to support parochial schools where children could receive instruction from members of their own faith. Seward's school proposal provoked a violent reaction among nativist Protestants. They accused him of plotting to overthrow Republican institutions by undoing the separation of church and state. Handbills charged that Seward was in league with the Pope and schemed to throw Protestant children into the hands of priests. In the end, the legislature passed a compromise plan that simply expanded the public school system. But the nativists, whose strength would grow dramatically in the decades ahead, never forgave Seward. Indeed, their opposition would eventually prove a fatal stumbling block to Seward's hopes for the presidential nomination in 1860. If Seward's progressive policies on education and immigration made him an influential and controversial figure in New York State, his defiant stand against slavery in the Virginia case brought him into national prominence in the late 1830s and early 1840s. In September 1839, a vessel sailing from Norfolk, Virginia, to New York, was found to have carried a fugitive slave. The slave was returned to his master in Virginia, in compliance with Article 4, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, that persons held to service or labor in one state, escaping into another, should be delivered up to the owner. When Virginia also demanded the arrest and surrender of three free black seamen who had allegedly conspired to hide the slave on the vessel, the New York governor refused. In a statement that brought condemnation throughout the South, Seward argued that the seamen were charged with a crime that New York State did not recognize. People were not property, and therefore no crime had been committed. On the contrary, the universal sentiment of civilized nations considered helping a slave escape from bondage not only innocent, but humane and praiseworthy. As controversy over the fate of the three sailors was prolonged, the Commonwealth of Virginia enacted a series of retaliatory measures to damage the commerce of New York, calling upon other southern states to pass resolutions denouncing Seward and the state of New York for intermeddling with their time-honored domestic institutions. Democratic periodicals in the North warned that the governor's stance would compromise highly profitable New York trade connections with Virginia and other slave states. Seward was branded a bigoted New England fanatic. This only emboldened Seward's resolve to press the issue. He spurred the Whig-dominated state legislature to pass a series of anti-slavery laws affirming the rights of black citizens against seizure by Southern agents, guaranteeing a trial by jury for any person so apprehended, and prohibiting New York police officers and jails from involvement in the apprehension of fugitive slaves. Such divisive incidents, the new irritation foreseen by Jefferson in 1820, widened the schism between North and South. Though few slaves actually escaped to the North each year, an estimated 100 or 200 out of the millions held in bondage, the issue exacerbated rancor on both sides. In the North, William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, called for immediate emancipation and racial equality, denouncing slavery as sinful and inhumane, advocating all actions, even in defiance of the Constitution, to bring an end to the empire of Satan. Such scathing criticisms moved Southern leaders to equally fierce defenses. They proclaimed slavery a positive good, rather than a mere necessity, of immense benefit to whites and blacks alike. As discord between North and South escalated, many Northerners turned against the abolitionists. Fear that the movement would destroy the Union incited attacks on abolitionist printers in the North and West. Presses were burned, editors threatened with death should their campaign persist. In 1840, Seward was re-elected governor, but by a significantly smaller margin. His dwindling support was blamed on the parochial school controversy, the protracted fight with Virginia, and a waning enthusiasm for social reform. Horace Greeley editorialized that Seward would henceforth be honored more for the 3,000 votes he has lost, considering the causes, than for all he has received in his life. Nonetheless, Seward decided not to run a third time. "All that can now be worthy of my ambition," he explained to a friend, "is to leave the state better for my having been here, and to entitle myself to a favorable judgment in its history." Throughout the dispute with the state of Virginia, and every other controversy that threatened Seward's highly successful tenure, Weed had proved a staunch ally and friend, answering critics in the legislature, publishing editorials in the Albany Evening Journal, ever sustaining Seward's spirits. "What am I to deserve such friendship and affection?" Seward asked him in 1842, as his second term drew to its close. "Without your aid, how hopeless would have been my prospect of reaching the elevation from which I am descending. How could I have sustained myself there? How could I have secured the joyous reflections of this hour? What would have been my prospect of future life but for the confidence I so undeniingly reposed on your affection?" Returning to Auburn, Seward resumed his law practice, concentrating now on lucrative patent cases. He found that his fight with Virginia had endeared him to anti-slavery men throughout the North. Members of the new Liberty Party bandied about his name in their search for a presidential candidate in 1844. Organized in 1840, the Liberty Party was born of frustration with the failure of either major party to deal head-on with slavery. The abrogation of slavery was their primary goal. Though flattered by the attention, Seward could not yet conceive of leaving the Whig Party. Meanwhile, he continued to speak out on behalf of black citizens. In March 1846, a terrifying massacre took place in Seward's hometown. A 23-year-old black man named William Freeman, recently released from prison after serving 5 years for a crime it was later determined he did not commit, entered the home of John Van Nest, a wealthy farmer and friend of Seward's. Armed with 2 knives, he killed Van Nest, his pregnant wife, their small child, and Mrs. Van Nest's mother. When he was caught within hours, Freeman immediately confessed. He exhibited no remorse and laughed uncontrollably as he spoke. The sheriff hauled him away, barely reaching the jail ahead of an enraged mob intent upon lynching him. "I trust in the mercy of God that I shall never again be a witness to such an outburst of the spirit of vengeance as I saw while they were carrying the murderer past our door," Frances Seward told her husband, who was in Albany at the time. Fortunately, the law triumphed. Frances recognized at once an incomprehensible aspect to the entire affair, and she was correct. Investigation revealed a history of insanity in Freeman's family. Moreover, Freeman had suffered a series of floggings in jail that had left him deaf and deranged. When the trial opened, no lawyer was willing to take Freeman's case. The citizens of Auburn had threatened violence against any member of the bar who dared to defend the cold-blooded murderer. When the court asked, "Will anyone defend this man?" a death-like stillness pervaded the crowded room. Until Seward rose, his voice strong with emotion, and said, "May it please the court, I shall remain counsel for the prisoner until his death." Seward's friends and family, including Thurlow Weed and Judge Miller, roundly criticized Seward for his decision. Only Frances stood proudly by her husband during the outburst that followed, assuring her sister that he will do what is right. He will not close his eyes and know that a great wrong is perpetrated. To her son Gus, she noted that there are few men in America who would have sacrificed so much for the cause of humanity. He has his reward in a quiet conscience and a peaceful mind. Though her house and children were her entire world, she never flinched when retaliation against Seward's decision threatened her family. She remained steadfast throughout. Then in her early 40s, she was a handsome woman, despite the hard, drawn look imparted by ill health. Over the years, she had grown intellectually with her husband, sharing his passion for reading, his reformer's spirit, and his deep hatred of slavery. Defying her father and her neighbors, she sat in the courtroom each day, her quiet bearing lending strength to her husband. Seward spent weeks investigating the case, interviewing Freeman's family, and summoning 5 doctors who testified to the prisoner's extreme state of mental illness. In his summation, he pleaded with the jury not to be influenced by the color of the accused man's skin. "He is still your brother and mine. Hold him, then, to be a man." Seward continued, "I am not the prisoner's lawyer. I am the lawyer for society, for mankind, shocked beyond the power of expression at the scene I have witnessed here of trying a maniac as a malefactor." He argued that Freeman's conduct was unexplainable on any principle of sanity, and begged the jury not to seek the death sentence. "Commit him to an asylum for the term of his natural life," Seward urged. "There is not a white man or white woman who would not have been dismissed long since from the perils of such a prosecution." There was never any doubt that the local jury would return a guilty verdict. "In due time, gentlemen of the jury," Seward concluded, "when I shall have paid the debt of nature, my remains will rest here in your midst with those of my kindred and neighbors. It is very possible they may be unhonored, neglected, spurned. But, perhaps years hence, when the passion and excitement which now agitate this community shall have passed away, some wandering stranger, some lone exile, some Indian, some Negro, may erect over them a humble stone, and thereon this epitaph, 'He was faithful.'" More than a century afterward, visitors to Seward's grave at the Fort Hill Cemetery in Auburn would find those very words engraved on his tombstone. While Seward endured the hostility of his hometown, his defense of Freeman became famous throughout the country. His stirring summation was printed in dozens of newspapers and reprinted in pamphlet form for still wider distribution. Salmon Chase, himself a leading proponent of the black man's cause, conceded to his abolitionist friend Lewis Tappan that he esteemed Seward as "one of the very first public men of our country. Who but himself would have done what he did for that poor wretch Freeman?" "His willingness to represent Freeman," Chase continued, "considering his own personal position and the circumstances, was magnanimous in the highest degree." So, in the mid-1840s, as Seward settled back into private life in Auburn, his optimism about the future remained intact. He had established a national reputation based upon principle and a vision of national progress. He trusted that when his progressive principles once more gained favor with the masses, he would return to public life. Abraham Lincoln, like Seward and Bates, was drawn to politics in his early years. At the age of 23, after only 6 months in New Salem, Illinois, he decided to run for the state legislature from Sangamon County. While it must have seemed next to impossible that a new settler who had just arrived in town with no family connections and little formal education could compete for office, his belief in himself and awareness of his superior intellectual abilities proved to be powerful motivators. Both his ambition and his uncertainty are manifest in the March 1832 statement formally announcing his candidacy on an essentially Whig platform that called for internal improvements, public education, and laws against usury. "Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition," he wrote. "I have no other so great as that of being truly esteemed of my fellow men, by rendering myself worthy of their esteem. How far I shall succeed in gratifying this ambition is yet to be developed." Lincoln already possessed the lifelong dream he would restate many times in the years that followed, the desire to prove himself worthy, to be held in great regard, to win the veneration and respect of his fellow citizens. "I am young and unknown to many of you," he continued. "I was born and have ever remained in the most humble walks of life. I have no wealthy or popular relations to recommend me. My case is thrown exclusively upon the independent voters of this county, and if elected, they will have conferred a favor upon me, for which I shall be unremitting in my labors to compensate. But if the good people in their wisdom shall see fit to keep me in the background, I have been too familiar with disappointments to be very much chagrined." At the same time, he made it clear that this try would not be his last, telling voters that only after being defeated some 5 or 6 times would he feel disgraced and never to try it again. His campaign was interrupted when he joined the militia to fight against the Sac and Fox Indians in what became known as the Black Hawk War. Mustered out after 3 months, he returned home shortly before the election. Not surprisingly, when the votes were tallied, the little-known Lincoln had lost the election. Despite his defeat, he took pride that in his own small town of New Salem, where he made friends everywhere he went, he had received 277 of the 300 votes cast. This astonishing level of support was attributed to his good nature and the remarkable gift for telling stories that had made him a favorite of the men who gathered each night in the general store to share opinions and gossip. "This was the only time," Lincoln later asserted, "that he was ever beaten on a direct vote of the people." 2 years later, he ran for the seat a second time. By then he had widened his set of acquaintances beyond New Salem, and won easily, capturing the first of 4 successive terms in the state legislature. Until he joined the new Republican Party, Lincoln would remain a steadfast Whig, as were Seward, Bates, and, for a brief moment, Chase. Lincoln's 4 successful campaigns for the legislature were conducted across a sparsely populated frontier county the size of Rhode Island. "Young Lincoln was always the center of the circle wherever he was," wrote Robert Wilson, a political colleague. "His stories were fresh and sparkling, never tinctured with malevolence." Though his face, in repose, revealed nothing marked or striking, when animated by a story, several wrinkles would diverge from the inner corners of his eyes and extend down and diagonally across his nose. His eyes would sparkle, all terminating in an unrestrained laugh in which everyone present, willing or unwilling, were compelled to take part. This rapid illumination of Lincoln's features in conversation would be observed by countless others throughout his entire life, drawing many into his orbit. During the campaigns, candidates journeyed on horseback across entirely unoccupied prairies, speaking at country stores and small villages. "The speaking would begin in the forenoon," Wilson recalled, "the candidates speaking alternately until all who could speak had his turn, generally consuming the whole afternoon." Nor were the contests limited to speeches on public issues. At Mr. Kyle's store, west of Springfield, a group of Democrats made a wager. "See here, Lincoln, if you can throw this cannonball further than we can, we'll vote for you." Lincoln picked up the large cannonball, felt it, swung it around and around, and said, "Well, boys, if that's all I have to do, I'll get your votes." He then proceeded to swing the cannonball 4 or 6 feet further than anyone could throw it. When he moved to Springfield in 1837, Lincoln began to attract the circle of friends and admirers who would play a decisive role in his political ascent. While he worked during the day to build his law practice, evenings would find him in the center of Springfield's young men, gathered around a fire in Speed's store to read newspapers, gossip, and engage in philosophical debates. They came there, Speed recalled, because they were sure to find Lincoln, who never failed to entertain with his remarkable stories. It was a sort of social club, Speed observed. Whigs and Democrats alike gathered to discuss the events of the day. Among the members of this club were three future U.S. senators: Stephen Douglas, who would become Lincoln's principal rival; Edward Baker, who would introduce him at his first inaugural and become one of the first casualties of the Civil War; and Orville Browning, who would assist his fight for the presidential nomination. Throughout his 8 years in the state legislature, Lincoln proved an extraordinarily shrewd grassroots politician, working to enlist voter support in the precincts for his party's candidates. While Seward could concentrate on giving voice to the party platform, relying on Weed to build poll lists and carry voters to the polls, Lincoln engaged in every aspect of the political process, from the most visionary to the most mundane. His experience taught him what every party boss has understood through the ages: the practical machinery of the party organization, the distribution of ballots, the checklists, the rounding up of voters, was as crucial as the broad ideology laid out in the platform. The same intimate involvement in campaign organization that he displayed in these early years would characterize all of Lincoln's future campaigns. His 1840 campaign plan divided the party organization into three levels of command. The county captain was to procure from the poll books a separate list for each precinct of everyone who had previously voted the Whig slate. The list would then be divided by each precinct captain into sections of 10 who reside most convenient to each other. The captain of each section would then be responsible to see each man of his section face to face and procure his pledge to vote as early on the day as possible. That same year, Lincoln and four Whig colleagues, including Joshua Speed, published a circular directed at the presidential campaign of William Henry Harrison. "Our intention is to organize the whole state so that every Whig can be brought to the polls." To this end, the publication outlined a plan whereby each county would be divided into small districts, each responsible for making a perfect list of all their voters, designating which names were likely, from past behavior, to vote with the Whigs and which were doubtful. Committees in each district would then keep a constant watch on the doubtful voters, and from time to time have them talked to by those in whom they have the most confidence. These committees were to submit monthly progress reports to the Central State Committee, ensuring an accurate survey of voters in each county before Election Day. Party workers could then be dispatched to round up the right voters and get them to the polls to support the Whig Party. In setting forth his campaign plan, as meticulously structured as any modern effort to get out the vote, Lincoln did not neglect the necessity of fundraising, asking each county to send $50 or $100 to subscribe to a newspaper devoted exclusively to the great cause in which we are engaged. Lincoln likened his politics to an old woman's dance, short and sweet. He stood for three simple ideas. a national bank, a protective tariff, and a system for internal improvements. A state legislator could do little to promote a national bank or raise tariffs, but internal improvements, which then usually meant the improvement of roads, rivers, harbors, and railways, were largely a local matter. Many Whigs, Seward and Bates among them, spoke of improving waterways, but Lincoln had actually worked on a flatboat to bring meat and grain down the Mississippi to New Orleans. He had a flatboatman's knowledge of the hazards posed by debris and logs while navigating the Sangamon River. Nor would he ever forget the thrill of receiving his first dollar for transporting two gentlemen on his flatboat from the riverbank to their steamer, which was anchored in the middle of the river. The experience of earning two $2 in a single day made the world seem wider and fairer, giving him confidence in the future. Lincoln knew firsthand the deprivations, the marginal livelihood of the subsistence farmer unable to bring produce to market without dependable roads. He had been paid the meager wages of the hired hand. Primitive roads, clogged waterways, lack of rail connections, inadequate schools. Such were not merely issues to Lincoln, but hurdles he had worked all his life to overcome in order to earn an ampler share of freedom. These improvements to the infrastructure would enable thousands of farming families to emerge from the kind of poverty in which the Lincoln family had been trapped, and would permit new cities and towns to flourish. Lincoln's dedication to internal improvements and economic development was given strength, nourishment, and power, so the historian Gabor Borit persuasively argues, by his passionate commitment to the ideal that all men should receive a full, good, and ever-increasing reward for their labors, so they might have the opportunity to rise in life. Economic development provided the basis, Lincoln said much later, that would allow every American an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. To Lincoln's mind, the fundamental test of a democracy was its capacity to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all. A real democracy would be a meritocracy, where those born in the lower ranks could rise as far as their natural talents and discipline might take them. Young Lincoln's great ambition in the 1830s, he told Joshua Speed, was to be the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois. The pioneering New York governor had opened opportunities for all New Yorkers and left a permanent imprint on his state when he persuaded the legislature to support the Erie Canal project. In the Illinois legislature, Lincoln hoped to leave a similar imprint by way of an ambitious program of internal improvements. During these same years, the young state legislator made his first public statement on slavery. The rise of abolitionism in the North, and the actions of governors such as Seward, who refused to fully respect fugitive slave provisions in the Constitution, led legislatures in both South and North to pass resolutions that censured abolitionism and confirmed the constitutional right to slavery. In conservative Illinois, populated by many citizens of Southern birth, the General Assembly fell in line. By the lopsided vote of 77-6, the Assembly resolved that "We highly disapprove of the formation of abolition societies, hold sacred the right of property in slaves, and believe that the general government cannot abolish slavery in the District of Columbia against the consent of the citizens." Lincoln was among the six dissenting voices. With one other colleague who had also voted against the resolution, he issued a formal protest. This protest did not endorse abolitionism, For Lincoln believed, then as later, that the Constitution did not give Congress the power to interfere with slavery in the states where it was already established. Instead, resisting the tide of public opinion in Illinois, Lincoln proclaimed that the institution of slavery is founded on both injustice and bad policy, and affirmed the constitutional power of Congress to abolish slavery in areas under federal control, such as the District of Columbia, though he recommended that that power ought not to be exercised unless at the request of the people of said district. Lincoln always believed, he later said, that if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. And he could not remember when he did not so think and feel. Though he was born in the slave state of Kentucky, his parents had been anti-slavery. Their opposition had led them to change religious congregations, and eventually they had moved to the free state of Indiana, partly on account of slavery. Decades later, in his short autobiography written for the 1860 presidential campaign, Lincoln would describe his protest in the Illinois legislature as one that briefly defined his position on the slavery question, and so far as it goes, it was then the same that it is now. In these early years, however, Lincoln paid the slavery issue less attention than Seward or Chase, believing that so long as slavery could be restricted to places where it already existed, it would gradually become extinct. He did not share Chase's professional and personal aversion to slave owners, and did not hesitate to take whatever clients came his way. In the course of his practice, Lincoln defended both slave owners and fugitive slaves. While he hated to see fugitive slaves hunted down, he publicly criticized the governor of Maine when he, like Seward, refused to give up two men who had aided a fugitive slave from Georgia. For Lincoln, the constitutional requirements for the return of fugitive slaves could not be evaded. Lincoln's dreams of becoming the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois collapsed when a sustained recession hit the state in 1837. Public sentiment turned against the costly and still unfinished internal improvement system. For months, Lincoln fervently defended the system against the rising tide of criticism, likening the abandonment of the canal to stopping a skiff in the middle of a river. If it was not going up, it would go down. Although his arguments fell on deaf ears, he refused to give ground, abiding by his father's old maxim, "If you make a bad bargain, hug it the tighter." His unwillingness to abandon the policies he had championed became self-destructive stubbornness. By 1840, the fourth year of recession, the mood in the legislature was set against continuing these projects. With funds no longer forthcoming, the improvement system collapsed. The state bank was forced to liquidate. Land values fell precipitously, and new pioneers were deterred from emigrating to Illinois. As a vocal proponent of the system that had aggravated the state's fiscal catastrophe, Lincoln received a significant share of the blame. Though he managed to win a fourth term in 1840, he polled the least number of votes among the victorious candidates, his poorest showing since his first election. Belief in himself and his progressive agenda shaken, he resolved to retire from the legislature after his term was completed. This failure of Lincoln's political ambition coincided with a series of crises in his personal life. Despite his humor, intellectual passion, and oratorical eloquence, he had always been awkward and self-conscious in the presence of women. He was not very fond of girls, his stepmother remembered. His gangly appearance and uncouth behavior did little to recommend him to the ladies. "He would burst into a ball," recalled a friend, "with his big, heavy Conestoga boots on, and exclaim aloud, 'Oh, boys, how clean those girls look!'" This was undoubtedly not the compliment the girls were looking for. Lincoln's friend, Henry Whitney, provides a comic recollection of leaving Lincoln alone with some women at a social gathering, and returning to discover him as demoralized and ill at ease as a bashful country boy. He would put his arms behind him and bring them to the front again, as if trying to hide them, and he tried, apparently but in vain, to get his long legs out of sight. His female friendships were confined mostly to older, safely married women. Never at ease talking with women, Lincoln found writing to them equally awkward. "A business which I do not understand." In Stephen Vincent Benet's epic poem, John Brown's Body, Lincoln expresses his difficulties with the fairer sex. "When the genius of the water moves, and that's the woman's genius, I'm at sea in every sense and meaning of the word, with nothing but old Patience for my chart, and Patience doesn't always please a woman." His awkwardness did not imply a lack of sexual desire. "Lincoln had terribly strong passions for women, could scarcely keep his hands off them," said his law partner, William Herndon, who added that his honor and a strong will enabled him to put out the fires of his terrible passion. Judge David Davis, Lincoln's companion on the circuit, agreed with this assessment, noting that "his conscience kept him from seduction. This saved many, many a woman." Before his marriage, Lincoln enjoyed close relations with young women and almost certainly found outlets for his sexual urges among the prostitutes who were readily available on the frontier. A year after Anne Rutledge's death, Lincoln courted Mary Owens, the sister of his friend Mrs. Elizabeth Abel. Mary Owens was said to be handsome, with dark blue eyes and much vivacity. Well-educated, she hailed from a comfortably affluent family in Kentucky and was noted as a good conversationalist and a splendid reader. Lincoln had met Miss Owens several years earlier when she visited her sister for a month in New Salem. In the aftermath of Anne Rutledge's death, Elizabeth Abel told Lincoln she thought the young pair would make a good match and proposed going to Kentucky to bring her sister back. Lincoln was confoundedly well pleased with the idea. He remembered that she was likable, smart, and a good companion, although somewhat oversize. When the 28-year-old Mary Owens returned to Illinois, however, a disturbing transformation had taken place. "She now appeared," he later wrote, with perhaps some exaggeration, "a fair match for Falstaff, with a want of teeth, weather-beaten appearance, and a size unattainable in less than 35 or 40 years. He tried in vain to persuade himself that the mind was much more to be valued than the person. He attempted to imagine she was handsome, which, but for her unfortunate corpulency, was actually true. He conjured up ways he might procrastinate the evil day, when he had to make good on his promise of marriage, but finally felt honor-bound to keep his word. His proposal, written on May 7, 1837, may well be one of the most curiously unappealing ever penned. "This thing of living in Springfield is rather a dull business after all," he observed of the dismal life she might share. "I am afraid you would not be satisfied. There is a great deal of flourishing about in carriages here, which it would be your doom to see without sharing in it. You would have to be poor without the means of hiding your poverty. Do you believe you could bear that patiently? What I have said I will most positively abide by, provided you wish it. My opinion is that you had better not do it. You have not been accustomed to hardship, and it may be more severe than you now imagine. Yours, etc., Lincoln." Not surprisingly, Mary Owens turned him down. Her rejection prompted Lincoln to write a humorous, self-deprecating letter to his friend Eliza Browning, Orville Browning's wife. He acknowledged that he was mortified almost beyond endurance to think that she, whom I had taught myself to believe nobody else would have, had actually rejected me with all my fancied greatness. And to cap the whole, I then, for the first time, began to suspect that I was really a little in love with her. He resolved never again to think of marrying, and for this reason, I can never be satisfied with anyone who would be blockhead enough to have me. Despite his disclaimer, 18 months later, the 31-year-old Lincoln became engaged to the lively and intelligent Mary Todd. The Edwards mansion on the hill, where Mary had come to stay with her sister Elizabeth, was the center of Springfield society. Lincoln was among the many young men who gathered in the Edwards parlor, where the girls dressed in the latest fashion, shared food, drink, and merry conversation. To their friends and relatives, Mary and Abe seemed the exact reverse of each other, physically, temperamentally, emotionally. She was short and voluptuous, her ample bosom accentuated by stays. He was uncommonly tall and cadaverous. While Mary possessed an open, passionate, and impulsive nature, her face an index to every passing emotion, he was, even Mary admitted, a self-controlled man. What he felt most deeply, Mary observed, he expressed the least. She was in her element at social gatherings, the very creature of excitement. Vivacious and talkative, she was capable of making a bishop forget his prayers, while Lincoln's good nature made him a welcome guest everywhere, one Springfield woman recalled. He rarely danced, much preferring a position amid the men he could entertain effortlessly with his amusing stories. For all their differences, the couple had much in common. Lincoln had always been attracted to intelligent women, and Mary was a woman of intellectual gifts who had earned the highest marks in school and taken home the biggest prizes. Endowed with an excellent memory, a quick wit, and a voracious appetite for learning, she shared Lincoln's love for discussing books and poetry. Like Lincoln, she could recite substantial passages of poetry from memory, and they shared a love of Robert Burns. Indeed, 4 years after Lincoln's death, Mary journeyed to the poet's birthplace in Scotland, where, recalling one of her favorite poems about a lost love, she sighed over poor Highland Mary's grave. Also, like Lincoln, she was fascinated by politics, having grown up in a political household. Among her happiest childhood memories were the sparkling dinner parties at her elegant brick house in Lexington, hosted by her father, Robert Todd, a Whig loyalist who had served in both the Kentucky House and Senate. At these sumptuous feasts, Lincoln's idol, Henry Clay, was a frequent guest, along with members of Congress, cabinet members, governors, and foreign ministers. Mesmerized by their discussions, Mary became, her sisters recalled, a violent little Whig, convinced that she was destined to be the wife of some future president. Undoubtedly, Mary told Lincoln of her many personal contacts with Clay, including how she once proudly rode her new pony to the statesman's house. And she shared with him a vital interest in the political struggles of the day. "I suppose, like the rest of us Whigs," she wrote a close friend in 1840, "you have been rejoicing in the recent election of General William Henry Harrison, a cause that has excited such deep interest in the nation and one of such vital importance to our prosperity. This fall I became quite a politician, rather an unladylike profession, yet at such a crisis, whose heart could remain untouched while the energies of all were called in question?" Lincoln was deeply engaged at the same time in the great cause of electing the old hero. Beyond their love of poetry and politics, Mary and Abraham had both lost their mothers at an early age. Mary was only 6 when her 31-year-old mother, Eliza Parker Todd, died, giving birth to her 7th child. Eliza's death, unlike the death of Nancy Hanks, did not disrupt the physical stability of the household. The Todd slaves continued to cook the meals, care for the children, fetch the wood, bank the fires, and drive the carriages as they had always done. If Lincoln was fortunate in his father's choice of a second wife, however, Mary's loss was aggravated by her father's remarriage. Elizabeth Humphreys, a severe stepmother with cold blue eyes, gave birth to 9 additional children, openly preferring her brood of Todds to the original clan. From the moment her stepmother moved in, Mary later recalled, her childhood turned desolate. Henceforth, she lamented, her only real home was the boarding school to which she was exiled at the age of 14. This estrangement, combined with a family history of mental instability and a tendency toward severe migraines, produced in Mary what one friend described as an emotional temperament, much like an April day, sunning all over with laughter one moment, the next crying as though her heart would break. She could be affectionate, generous, and optimistic one day, vengeful, depressed, and irritable the next. In the colloquial language of her friends, she was either in the garret or cellar. In either mood, she needed attention, something the self-contained Lincoln was not always able to provide. As their courtship proceeded, the very qualities that had first attracted the couple to each other may have become sources of conflict. Initially drawn to Mary by her ability to command any gathering with her intense energy, Lincoln may well have determined that this reflected a tiresome and compulsive need. Mary may have come to define Lincoln's patience and objectivity as aloofness and inconsiderateness. We know only that at some point in the winter of 1840-41, as they approached marriage, a break occurred in their relationship. While the inner lives of men and women living long ago are never easy to recover, the difficulty is compounded here by the absence of intimate letters between Mary and Abraham. Seward, Chase, and Bates disclosed their deepest feelings in their diaries and letters, but not a single letter survives from the days of the Lincolns' courtship, and only a precious few remain from the years of their marriage. While the emotional lives of Lincoln's rivals still seem alive to us more than a century and a half after their deaths, the truth about Lincoln's courtship is harder to recapture. Inevitably, in the vacuum created by the absence of documents, gossip and speculation flourish. Mary may have precipitated the break, influenced by the objections of her sister Elizabeth and her brother-in-law, Ninian Edwards, who believed she was marrying beneath her. Elizabeth warned Mary that she did not think that Mr. L. and she were suitable to each other. The couple considered that Mary and Abraham's natures, mind, education, raising, etc., were so different they could not live happy as husband and wife. Mary had other suitors, including Edwin Webb, a well-to-do widower, Stephen Douglas, the up-and-coming Democratic politician, and, as Mary wrote her friend, Mercy Ann Levering, an agreeable lawyer and grandson of Patrick Henry. What an honor! Still, she insisted, I love him not, and my hand will never be given where my heart is not. With several good men to choose from, Mary may have decided she needed time to think through her family's pointed reservations about Lincoln. Far more likely, Lincoln's own misgivings prompted a retreat from this second engagement. Though physically attracted to Mary, he seemed to question the strength of his love for her as he approached a final commitment. Joshua Speed recalled that, in the winter of 40 and 41, Lincoln was very unhappy about his engagement to Mary, not being entirely satisfied that his heart was going with his hand. Speed's choice of the same phrase that Mary used suggests that it must have been a common expression to indicate an embrace of marriage without the proper romantic feelings. How much Lincoln suffered, Speed recalled, none know so well as myself. He disclosed his whole heart to me. Recent scholarship has suggested that Lincoln's change of heart was influenced by his affection for Ninian Edwards's cousin, Matilda Edwards, who had come to spend the winter in Springfield. A lovelier girl I never saw, Mary herself conceded upon first meeting Matilda. Orville Browning traced Lincoln's aberration of mind to the predicament in which he found himself, engaged to Miss Todd and in love with Miss Edwards, and his conscience troubled him dreadfully for the supposed injustice he had done and the supposed violation of his word. While there is no evidence that Lincoln ever made his feelings known to Matilda, Browning's observation is supported by an acquaintance's letter describing the complicated situation. Though Lincoln was committed to Mary, Springfield resident Jane Bell observed, he could never bear to leave Miss Edwards' side in company. He thought her so perfect that if he had it in his power, he would not have one feature in her face altered. His indiscreet behavior drew criticism from his friends, Bell claimed, who thought he was acting very wrong and very imprudently, and told him so, and he went crazy on the strength of it. Possibly, Lincoln's infatuation with Matilda was merely a distraction from the anxiety surrounding his impending marriage to Mary. According to Elizabeth Edwards, Lincoln was apprehensive about his ability and capacity to please and support a wife, and doubtful about the institution of marriage itself. He likely feared that a wife and family would undermine his concentration and purpose. He would be responsible for the life and happiness of a woman accustomed to wealth and luxury. He would be unable to read late into the nights, pursuing new knowledge and the mastery of law and politics. His fear that marriage might hinder his career was a common one. The uncertainties of establishing a legal practice in the new market economy of the mid-19th century caused many young lawyers to delay wedlock, driving up the marriage age. The Harvard law professor Joseph Story is famously quoted as saying that the law is a jealous mistress and requires a long and constant courtship. What applied to the law applied still more to politics. For Lincoln, struggling to establish himself in both, marriage must have presented pitfalls for his enormous ambitions. Lincoln drafted a letter to Mary, ending the engagement. He asked Speed to deliver it, but Speed refused, warning that he should talk to her instead. For once put your words in writing, and they stand as a living and eternal monument against you. Lincoln did go to see Mary, and, according to Speed, told her that he did not love her. As soon as she began to weep, he lost his nerve. "To tell you the truth, Speed, it was too much for me. I found the tears trickling down my own cheeks. I caught her in my arms and kissed her." The engagement was temporarily renewed, and Lincoln was forced into another meeting to sever the engagement. This second confrontation left him devastated, both because he had hurt Mary and because he had long held his ability to keep his resolves when they are made as the only, or at least the chief, gem of his character. During this grim winter, sorrows came to Lincoln, not single spies, but in battalions. Joshua Speed announced his intention to return in a few months' time to his family's plantation in Louisville, Kentucky. Speed's father had died, and he felt responsible for his grieving mother. On January 1, 1841, he sold his interest in the general store where he had lived and worked for 7 years. Speed's departure would bring an end to the pleasant evenings around the fireplace, where the young men of Springfield had gathered to discuss politics. More discouraging for Lincoln, Speed's departure meant the loss of the one friend to whom he had opened his heart in free and easy communion. "I shall be very lonesome without you," Lincoln told Speed. "How miserably things seem to be arranged in this world. If we have no friends, we have no pleasure, and if we have them, we are sure to lose them, and be doubly pained by the loss." The awkward dissolution of his engagement to Mary and the anticipated loss of his best friend, combined with the collapse of the internal improvement projects and the consequent damage to his reputation, to induce a state of mourning that deepened for weeks. He stopped attending the legislature and withdrew from the lively social life he had enjoyed. His friends worried that he was suicidal. According to Speed, Lincoln went crazy, had to remove razors from his room, take away all knives and other such dangerous things, etc. It was terrible. He was delirious to the extent of not knowing what he was doing, Orville Browning recalled, and for a period of time was incapable of talking coherently. "Poor L," James Conkling wrote to his future wife, Mercy Ann Levering. "He is reduced and emaciated in appearance, and seems scarcely to possess strength enough to speak above a whisper. His case at present is truly deplorable." In Lincoln's time, this combination of symptoms, feelings of hopelessness and listlessness, thoughts of death and suicide, was called hypochondriasis, the hypo, or the vapors. Its source was thought to be in the hypochondria, that portion of the abdomen which was then considered the seat of emotions, containing the liver, gallbladder, and spleen. Treatment for the liver and digestive system was recommended. "I have, within the last few days, been making a most discreditable exhibition of myself in the way of hypochondriaism," Lincoln confessed to his law partner and friend John Stuart on January 20, 1841. Desperately, he sought a post office job for Dr. Anson Henry, who would leave Springfield if the job did not materialize. His presence, Lincoln told Stuart, was necessary to my existence. 3 days later, Lincoln wrote Stuart again. "I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on the earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. I awfully forebode I shall not. To remain as I am is impossible. I must die or be better, it appears to me." Hoping medical treatment might assuage his sorrow, Lincoln consulted not only Dr. Henry, but Dr. Daniel Drake at the Medical College in Cincinnati. Drake was perhaps the most eminent medical scientist in the West. Lincoln described his condition at length in a letter and asked for counsel. The doctor wisely replied that he could not offer a diagnosis for Lincoln without a personal interview. Throughout the nadir of Lincoln's depression, Speed stayed at his friend's side. In a conversation both men would remember as long as they lived, Speed warned Lincoln that if he did not rally, he would most certainly die. Lincoln replied that he was more than willing to die, but that he had done nothing to make any human being remember that he had lived, and that to connect his name with the events transpiring in his day and generation, and so impress himself upon them as to link his name with something that would redound to the interest of his fellow man, was what he desired to live for. Even in this moment of despair, the strength of Lincoln's desire to engrave his name in history carried him forward. Like the ancient Greeks, Lincoln seemed to believe that ideas of a person's worth are tied to the way others, both contemporaries and future generations, perceive him. Unable to find comfort in the idea of a literal afterlife in heaven, he found consolation in the conviction that in the memories of others, some part of us remains alive. To see memory as the essence of life came naturally to Lincoln. Robert Bruce observes, for he was a man who seemed to live most intensely through the process of thought, the expression of thought, and the exchange of thought with others. Indeed, in a poem inspired by a visit to his childhood home, Lincoln emphasized the centrality of memory, which he described as, "Thou midway world, twixt earth and paradise." Fueled by his resilience, conviction, and strength of will, Lincoln gradually recovered from his depression. He understood, he told Speed later, that in times of anxiety, it is critical to avoid being idle, that business and conversation of friends were necessary to give the mind rest from that intensity of thought which will sometimes wear the sweetest idea threadbare and turn it to the bitterness of death. He returned to his law practice and his duties in the legislature, resuming his work on behalf of the Whig Party. That summer of 1841, he remedied the absence of good conversation and intimate friendship with a month-long visit to Speed in Kentucky. The following February, he delivered an eloquent address to a temperance society in Springfield. This speech not only revealed a man in full command of his powers, it illustrated Lincoln's masterful approach to leadership. He counseled temperance advocates that if they continued to denounce the dram seller and the drinker in thundering tones of anathema and denunciation, nothing would be accomplished. Far better to employ the approach of erring man to an erring brother, guided by the old adage that a drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall.